I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome. It's Friday. Yep, it's already Friday, folks, and we're here at the end of the week. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness, and we're glad you're here to round out your week with us. Tim will be back with me on Monday as we look into supernatural news and Parashare. We'll read more of your stories and report on all of the strange going-ons around the world this past week. Joining me tonight to end our week, Preston Dennett. He has been a guest of ours many years ago on Darkness Radio. He's back with us now to discuss his book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. True Accounts of Contact with Extraterrestrials. Preston, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and I'm sorry it's been so long. I'm glad that we're able to reconnect. For our listeners that may not be familiar with you, how did you get involved in UFO research?
Well, it wasn't voluntary. I was kind of dragged into it kicking and screaming. Didn't believe in this stuff, not at all. Really skeptical. But I heard this report in the news in 1986 about a sighting over Alaska. I'm sure you probably heard of it. It's very well known. A Japanese commercial airliner sighted this large disc, larger than their jet. And it tracked them for, gosh, about an hour, I believe it was, for many miles. Appeared on their radar. It was a huge case. The news was really tongue-in-cheek. They just kind of joked about it, laughed nervously, and moved on. But I remembered my brother, years ago, had said he'd seen a UFO. And I don't know, it just intrigued me. This pilot was putting his reputation on the line. I figured he's lying on drugs or something like this. But interesting enough to ask people about it. And got a real shock. Found out a lot of people I knew, people I loved and trusted, were keeping secrets from me. They were having really dramatic encounters with UFOs and other paranormal stuff, actually. And didn't tell me about it. I was really upset, actually.
Why weren't they telling you about it? Because you were such a staunch skeptic?
Yeah. And, you know, I asked them about that. And they're like, well, what would you have said? You know, you would have told us we were, you know, crazy. And, you know, they're probably right. But after, you know, my brother told me, my sister-in-law, she saw a UFO over Van Nuys Air Force Reserve Base with two friends, by the way. My brother had two friends when he chased a UFO across the San Fernando Valley here in California.
What do you mean by chased a UFO?
He was driving along with two friends and saw this, well, he described it as a metallic object with colored lights and a dome on top. It was pretty close to their car, so they drove after it. And this thing kind of led them along down Reseda Boulevard for several miles. They passed other cars who were also chasing it, pointing at it. And so they, yeah, chased it for a good 20, 30 minutes. It hit home for me.
Right. Well, I would guess so, sure. And you knew they weren't pulling your chain. These were legitimate, to them, legitimate experiences.
Exactly. And that's why I knew they weren't lying to me. and people at work too, people I'd worked with for years, friends. A friend had missing time. A lady at work saw a UFO with her whole family. Another lady at work, Dorothy, she walks in, hears us talking about UFOs, and she's like, oh, well, me and my friend Carol and my mom, we saw one at the library. It was right above our car. She says, you know, it's weird. We live 5 minutes from the library. This thing followed us home. And when we got home, you know, they left at 9 o'clock, right when the library closed. She said, when we got home, it was 10:15. She says, I have no idea how, you know, we lost all this time. And, this was, you know, back in the day.
Preston, where do you live that all of these people have had these experiences?
You know, that's exactly what I was thinking. I'm thinking, okay, it must be California. It's got to be. You know?
Right.
But I don't think it is, because I heard this report, or a quote, actually, from J. Allen Hynek,
mm-hmm.
Father of modern ufology, worked with Project Blue Book, eventually converted as a believer, and said that one in 40 people have had an onboard experience.
Onboard?
Yeah, basically an onboard UFO. And, of course, I'm thinking, well, no, you know, there's just no way. That's
right.
Way too. And I thought, well, you know, I know 40 people, I think. You know, between my friends, family, and coworkers.
Right.
I can do a little survey here. And I did. And I found 5 people who'd had at least a face-to-face encounter or missing time encounter or flat-out onboard experience.
How do you go about starting that conversation? You know, are you like, hey, did you see the game yesterday? Yeah, it was pretty amazing, huh? That blimp in the sky, that's pretty cool. By the way, speaking of blimps in the sky, have you ever seen a UFO? I mean, how do you broach that subject with somebody and try to get a legitimate straight answer and not have them, you know, jerking
right.
your chain a little?
Well, I learned the hard way, actually, you know, that I can clear a room pretty quickly at a party if I bring this up. Or, you know, but back in that day, I think there was a lot more skepticism than there is now, the ridicule factor. But, you know, I learned you get them in private, for one thing. And, if, you know, my brother, well, he would never admit anything until I got him drunk. And then I found out he had some really extraordinary paranormal experiences. I don't recommend that, obviously.
you don't recommend roofying your friends to get the real truth out of them about UFO and abduction?
A little sodium pentothal. You know,
right. How many books have you written now on UFOs?
I've written 20 books overall, and
wow.
This latest one is the 14th on UFOs.
Okay. Let's talk about this, the book Inside UFOs. What's this new one about?
Well, I'm actually really excited about this one because it's different from a lot of the other books I've written. Like, I did a series of UFOs over various states, sort of a history book of UFOs over California, New Mexico, New York, Arizona, and so on. And that drew on a lot of research from a lot of different people, a very wide net. Whereas this book is all my own research. These are people I've interviewed personally. And this latest book contains 10 of the more extensive and more unusual cases, or important cases, I think, that I've investigated, and each one involving missing time, an onboard experience, or a face-to-face encounter. So,
what do you choose? I mean, when you hear these encounters, and I'm sure after writing all of these books, you've heard from people all around the world, how do you choose which ones to include in books like this? What is the earmarking that you're looking for to say, you know what, this is a case that I find fascinating?
You know, if an unusual case I find fascinating, if someone has a run-of-the-mill abduction by Grays, and they tell me, oh, you know, they came into my bedroom, they said, don't be afraid, I won't hurt you. Next thing they know, they find themselves in a rounded room and they're being examined. I've heard that story. I've heard it 1,000 times, and it doesn't vary a whole lot, honestly. But there are a lot of unusual aspects to this phenomena, and when someone has extensive contact, they start to see more of the unusual experiences. And I was intrigued by one case involves a Navy man, a Navy medic. I was intrigued by him, his case, because he wasn't abducted. He was actually invited on board and was a great witness. Another guy was also in the Navy, an electronics specialist. So those stories I was kind of attracted to because these were great witnesses who had, you know, a profession that they were putting on the line. They allowed me to use their real names, had character witnesses to back them up. And when a case has evidence, I'm also intrigued by that. There's a case in the book involving a healing as well as a apparent implant. Actually, several of the cases involve implants. But when someone's not the typical abduction by grays.
Okay.
Interested
in. Yeah, ho-hum, just another abduction by grays, right? You've become jaded, Preston, when people's stories about being abducted by gray aliens and being tested and taken aboard ships is just kind of run-of-the-mill for you. Do you have a hard time trusting people with these type of stories? I mean, like, obviously you just said you've got some people that have great character witnesses and are putting themselves out there, and they're in a position where it could affect them ill,
right,
for their business or professional life or personal life, but they're coming forward to tell that story. So obviously they must be sincere, because why would they do that otherwise?
All right, well, people do lie. I mean, there's no doubt. We know that. People brag, I think, a lot. To determine if someone is telling the truth, there are, of course, various techniques that I use and I think other investigators use. First of all, when I interview someone, I do a preliminary interview. I'm not recording it. I'm just sort of gauging their story and what they have to say. And if I find that their story might deserve an interview, then I'll do a formal interview. And this is when you get a chance to see if their story varies at all. So that's one way. Another way is people talking about UFOs are very shy to talk about it often, particularly if they have a very dramatic encounter where they're, you know, taken on board. If someone's, you know, looking to get attention from people saying, oh, you know, I'm an abductee, they're going to get a rude shock, because this is not a story a lot of people want to hear, if you know what I mean. I mean, it kind of throws, right, shade on the witness, because people question your sanity.
Right.
But I found that people who come forth, you know, are very emotional. And this is definitely a marker that I think points towards these people are telling the truth. If they have a lot of trouble telling their story because it's so emotional for them. I've had people crying.
Sure.
People are often really relieved. It's very typical when I interview someone that they begin with some sort of caveat, a variation of, you know, I don't do drugs. Or, you know, I've got a college education. I've got a good,
right,
job.
They always feel the sense to validate their experience by making you realize that they're not some lunatic running in the woods naked at night howling to the moon. They're right, legitimate, stand-up, upright citizens.
And some of these people have physical evidence, mind you.
Now, what do you mean by physical evidence? Talk to me about what you consider to be physical evidence.
Well, there's various forms of evidence, obviously. Some people have only their eyewitness testimony, and that's tough. I really feel for those people, because they don't have any way of proving their story. But one lady I talked to, she had an illness, and it was very severe, and she had an experience, and this illness went away, and it was unexplainable. She went to the doctor as well, and they found an artifact in her lung, a metallic ring. There's just no way this thing can have gotten there. So the doctors are completely baffled and said, well, we're just going to watch this thing. Over the years, it's calcified over. Just recently, this case isn't in the book, but I've been corresponding with a family, a mother and son in the Midwest, and they sent me the x-rays of the teenager's mouth, dental x-rays, which show a foreign body under one of the tooth, under one of his molars. And multiple x-rays, comments from the dentist, our doctor's reports. So it's...
What are the dentists and doctors saying about this? Are they saying that there is a foreign body there? Are they saying that, yep, it is... Because I would guess that in the jawline there could be fractures of bone, maybe teeth that malformed could be causing this. What is standing out about it that makes them believe this does not belong where they're seeing it?
Oh, believe me, the dentists are upset. I contacted some dentists independently, and had them diagnose from the x-rays, which, you know, like I said, there's multiple x-rays. And this object is round. It's rather large, kind of half the size of a marble. It's directly under one of the molars. There's no entry wound. In one of the x-rays, it disappeared. It's not visible. And it came back again in another x-ray. So there's a lot of weird unexplained aspects to this. It's diagnosed by all the doctors that I've contacted and by her doctor, her dentist, as a foreign body. And they keep saying, well, you must have shot yourself in the mouth with a BB or a pellet gun.
Well, that's obvious, right? Of all things, that's what I must have done. Sorry about that. Yeah, now I remember. I shot myself with a pellet gun.
Yeah, and they all say that. They're like, well, it's got to be that. But there's no entry wound and no history of that. They've never had a gun. They would have remembered, right?
Right. Yeah, I would recall if I shot myself in the mouth with any kind of gun.
If you get shot in the face, I think you're going to remember.
Yes.
Or at least have something.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's great evidence. But other people have lesser evidence of, you know, foreign bodies in their sinus, which are not as clear-cut or, you know, perfectly round, perhaps. People wake up with scars, burns.
What do the doctors say of these strange bodies that appear in people's bodies that weren't there before? These strange little chips or you know, implants, whatever you want to call them. It should be easy enough to test, right? You pull it out, you run it under a microscope, and you can tell what it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some researchers who've specialized in that. The late Dr. Roger Lear did several cases of this, talked to some of his clients, talked to doctors about this, and certainly talked to a lot of witnesses. And generally speaking, the witnesses don't tell the doctors. I had one lady, she's had a cyst in her breast, diagnosed full on, and was going to have it removed, but had an experience like 2 days before. Went to the doctor, and the doctors were really upset. They couldn't find the cyst, but there was evidence that she had had surgery. She's like, well, no, I didn't, knowing full well, you know, that she probably did.
Right.
And the doctor's like, well, yeah, you did. You know, here's a little laser scar right here, and there's fluid in your one of her tubes there that is only present after having surgery. And she's like, no, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. So the doctors have a tough time with it. One doctor, he told me that, you know, I run across these foreign bodies every now and then, and he knows that other doctors do it. Some doctors think they're kind of just anomalies in the MRIs, perhaps, but when it shows up in multiple MRIs, they're like, well, you know, we don't know what they are, and they don't really make a whole big deal about it, because the witnesses aren't really forthcoming. That's part of the problem. I think if a witness said, you know, I was taken on board, you know, this thing happened, I've got a scar here, is there anything in there? And the MRI comes out positive. Well, yeah, we've got cases like that. I mean, this one guy interviewed, he's got foreign bodies in his brain. And he's like, well, no, I don't want brain surgery to have these things removed, which I can understand.
Right. Well, yeah, I would be worried that it would start attracting abnormal cells to it and create like a brain cancer if you found something in there. But yeah, I guess I can see where that's at. Now, as you're talking to all of these different people and collecting these stories, and, you know, you kind of already, you know, fanned away the little grays, as they are one of the more popular stories out there. What other types of extraterrestrials are people claiming to be seeing and witnessing?
Right. Well, it's still dominated by the grays for the most part. In my research, it's at least half, probably closer to 70%. But I'm getting lots more different cases these days. Now, it started, the whole UFO field, the modern age began in 1947, right? We had all these sightings, craft started landing. And then we had the contactee era of the 50s with human-looking ETs, which has kind of divided the UFO community to a little bit. A lot of them saying, these are hoaxes, George Adamski and so on. And some saying, well, maybe not. You know, Daniel Fry, probably a legitimate witness. He was a rocket scientist. But at any rate, those stories kind of went underground, were dominated by the grays. And I don't think the contactee era ever stopped. I think it was just kind of forced underground. And now I'm getting a lot more what you would call Nordic type ETs, which are ETs that look just like us, or, well, very much like us. Usually described as better looking and muscular and so on. But definitely that's a category that I'm seeing a lot more of. And that included.
And then if they look like us, how do we know that it's not just a human? Why are we automatically assuming it's an alien in nature?
Right. It definitely raises some serious questions about who we are, our nature to the ETs, if these are ETs at all, obviously. I think that they probably are, because they're not only different technologically wise, but spiritually, they're usually described as being very enlightened, very advanced, and having mental powers like telepathy and things like this, which generally speaking, we don't. But it's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, the grays look a lot like us too. Then there's the praying mantis. Mantids, I get quite a lot of those, actually. Beyond that, sort of this catch-all. I don't get a whole lot of reptilians, but they're definitely there every now and then.
Now, do you believe the reptilians are really aliens, or do you think they're Earth remnants? Do you think they're creatures that have always been here and are maybe our predecessors on this planet?
Well, yeah, maybe not extraterrestrial, but definitely alien as we think of it.
Right.
But what's interesting is the reptilian accounts don't usually involve UFOs, or often don't. People see them, you know, come into their home perhaps, or out while hiking in the wilderness or in caves. Presumably these guys supposedly come from here, inner Earth. I don't know if it's true. We don't have a whole lot of information about where these guys come from, any of them, really. Whatever type of ET you're talking about.
But it does sound like maybe there's a better possibility that they are from here.
Right.
As opposed to from outer space, or at least, you know, maybe they're originally from outer space, but maybe the reptilians have always been a part of our planet, and we're the aliens here.
Well, there's a big mythology about, you know, snake-like creatures on our planet.
Right.
More so than I think the standard ETs. Which I do find kind of interesting. But the whole ET phenomenon is very frustrating because it's really hard to categorize. Yeah, we have grays, but there's many different types of grays. And there's this catch-all category of humanoids that's impossible to categorize. I mean, it could be anything from short little hairy people to very tall. I've got a case of a 9-foot humanoid with orange straw-like hair, undescribed in a way I've never heard before. Robotic creatures, which, by the way, are almost always humanoid as well.
Hmm.
So, which I find kind of bizarre. I mean, why not have a floating sphere or something? Or, you know what I mean?
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, we're heading into a break. Why don't you tell me, share one of your favorite stories from the new book, one of your favorite cases, and we'll use that to lead into the new Theater of the Mind. What have you got for us?
Probably my favorite case is the first one, involving a Navy medic by the name of Kevin Camming. He was invited up aboard a UFO. He was on his Navy ship in the Philippines, and his bunkmate, Larry, comes up to him and says, "Oh, you know, I'm a UFO contactee. I've been in contact with aliens my whole life. They've taken me on board their ship. They've taken me to their planet, to other planets." And Kevin's like, "No, no way. I don't believe you." And a couple of days later, Larry comes back and says, "Well, my friends just took me to your house. This is, you know, in Kankakee, Illinois, thousands of miles away."
Mm-hmm.
And Larry proceeds to describe Kevin's house in detail. And Kevin is floored because all the details are correct, but they're all, and this is where it's really bizarre, they're all 10 years in the past, which Kevin's like, "Okay, you're right, but this is, how do you explain this? I mean, is this time travel or what's going on?" And he turns to Larry and says, "Okay, if this is true, I want to meet your little green friends." And Larry says, "Oh, okay, I'll see what I can do." Comes back a couple of days later and says, "Okay, they're coming tomorrow. They're going to come and be ready." The next day comes. Larry comes into the cavern and says, they're up on deck. Go up on deck. You'll see them. So Kevin's not believing this. Goes up on deck. Lo and behold, there's this giant UFO. You know, his ship is about 600 feet long. This thing, he said, it was at least three times the size, hovering off to the side of the ship. It was beautiful, covered with lights. Next thing he knows, no, actually, he runs over to get another witness, tries shaking the guy's shoulder. Next thing he knows, he's not on the Navy ship anymore. He's looking down at it from above, and the Navy ship is receding very quickly. He realizes, oh, no, now I'm aboard this UFO. I'm AWOL, he thought. And he hears a voice in his head, nope, no one even knows you're gone. It was a male voice, spoke perfect English. So he's freaking out. He's too afraid to turn around. He's looking out the side of the UFO, which turns transparent. He looks down at his feet. He can see there's a metal grating, he said, which reminded him of a fire escape. But looks out the side of the ship, which turns transparent. And next thing he knows, he's over his hometown in Illinois. It's daytime there as well. Impossible, because you know both the Philippines and Illinois can't be daytime at the same time. And he's hovering over his mom's place of work at a church where she teaches. And he can see through the wall of the UFO, through the wall of the church, into the classroom. And she's writing on a chalkboard. He's thinking, okay, this is bizarre. Next thing he knows, the ship moves like just a couple of blocks and is hovering over the bank building where his father works. And same thing, he can see through all the ductwork, the walls, the air conditioning, into the center of the building where his dad is having a meeting with executives. And he hears this voice in his head, presumably the ET, saying, your parents did a great job. They're very honorable people, and they did a good job. And he's like, oh, okay. He's wondering why they're telling him this. He says a lot of stuff happened. He doesn't remember all of it. Next thing he remembers, they're in a different place. He's looking down to the bottom of the ship. It's still transparent. And he can see a desert. It looks like gray sand. He sees craters. He's thinking, okay, it's a bombing range. He says, gosh, you know, it looks like the moon. And they come up over the horizon line, and there's the Earth in the distance. Tiny, about the size of a softball.
Now they're just showing off.
Right? He says he nearly messed his pants. That's not the words he used. But he says it was extremely traumatic for him. He pinched himself to the point where he bled. He showed me the scar. Just started asking questions at this point. He says, as soon as he had a thought, they would answer it immediately. He said, where are you from? And he said, the room expanded in size. This is a detail I hear rarely. And not a lot of people know, but apparently these UFOs can change size, even while you're aboard it. This is what I would call a red flag, and another way I use to determine if a person is telling the truth. By these kind of rare details not a lot of people know about. And he says, suddenly the room darkened and turned into this giant star chart. You could see our planet, you know, our solar system. You could see all these stars, and way off in the distance is this little red light blinking on and off. And they said, that's us. He says he heard three different voices talking to him. Different people would answer. And this went on for at least 20 minutes up to an hour of them answering his questions. They told him what they eat, fish and vegetables, this kind of thing. They told him that they speak all the languages of our planet. They told him that they're in touch with all our major governments and are trading technology with them. That other ETs are here as well. He asked about Roswell. They said, yes, that did happen. He asked them about God, and they told him they would not discuss race, religion, or politics, which I found really strange and kind of interesting.
So obviously they avoid Facebook.
Right? But these are issues that we're having a lot of trouble with, you know, resolving, right. I think, as a species. So perhaps that's part of it. I don't know. But they told him all kinds of stuff. They told him that when we started exploding atomic bombs, it started, quote, a countdown clock. They said, our destiny will be fulfilled and these events will happen. And they showed him all these disasters. Now, this is something I've heard quite a bit from people who've been taken on board. They're given warnings of some kind. Generally, there's messages that fall into three categories. Warnings is one of them. And they showed him live pictures of future events, including hurricanes, tornadoes, landslides, mine disasters, a personal motorcycle accident that he would eventually have, more hurricanes. And they told him, yeah, all these events will happen. Your destiny will be fulfilled. Finally, he asked him, okay, what do you look like? And they said, well, we're not little and we're not green. This is okay. And they said, well, our appearance might, you know, frighten people. Some people find our appearance frightening. And finally, he just turns around and gets a real shock. The room is smaller now. It's back to about 20 or 50 feet. And there are three kind of marble chairs in the center of the room on a dais. And sitting in each one of them is a giant praying mantis figure. Because it looked very much like a praying mantis, except they were bone white, very long, long stick-like limbs, and extremely tall. One of them stood up, took two steps across the room, and Kevin looked up at him. He estimates he was about 15 feet tall. And I tried to talk him down. I'm like, you're probably thinking, you know, maybe it's 9 or 10, because that's usually the limit that I hear. He says, no, no. You know, this thing was more than twice my height. It was taller than a basketball board. He's a trained observer, by the way. So I'm like, okay. And he said this thing turns to him. You know, first it's fussing with the dials on this console, which is much too high for Kevin, by the way. It comes up almost to his neck. There's little oven dials on it, amber lights, green lights, red lights. This figure turns to Kevin and says, would you like to go to our planet? And he said, no. He was too frightened at this point. He felt like he was going to become a specimen. He just wanted to go home. And next thing he knows, they reach out. It reaches out and touches him on the shoulder, grabs his shoulder. And he stiffens, just panics, faints, dead away, and wakes up. And he's no longer on board this UFO. He's back on the Navy ship. He's in his cabin. He's lying down in his bed, sweating profusely and hyperventilating. And he gets his bearings, and the curtain opens that's covering his bed. And there's his friend Larry grinning from ear to ear saying, so, how did you like your little ride? Well, he didn't like it. He was actually really upset, pretty traumatized, and stayed away from Larry for the rest of his yeah,
that's understandable. Wow.
Lost that. And here's a weird part too. He lost a lot of memory of this event. He remembered being taken on board, didn't remember what they looked like or what they told him, just kind of scattered images of, you know, his hometown and things like this, and didn't remember really until about 2 years later. About was watching a nature show on TV, and there came a close-up of a praying mantis, and this is what I call a cue. I had this in other cases, where something similar to their experience breaks down the wall of amnesia, and this is what happened to him. Suddenly, he remembers all of this stuff. It's like, oh my God! And yeah, he's a great witness. Really has no problem telling people about his experience, and wants people to know that this is real, and this really happened to him.
That is unbelievable. We need to take a break. We've got more to share. We'll talk about time travel, physical injuries, healings, and more of these strange UFO and alien encounters. Preston Dennett is our guest. It's time now. The skies are dark, but a light has shone, and the dark hives are open. It's time for Theater of the Mind. The Mantis Encounter of Hawaii. A story shared by Bill Murphy, formerly of the hit TV sci-fi channel series Fact or Fake, The Paranormal Files. I would like to share with you an unusual encounter I had in 2007 that occurred on the Big Island of Hawaii.
I booked a week at a resort called Kalani, which is a beautiful slice of paradise, where I met another 50 to 60 people who were there for a metaphysical retreat. I was drawn to the conference since I was using electroencephalograms for several years to measure the difference in brainwave frequencies of people who claimed to have an expanded awareness, including developing a sixth sense after intense meditation. Now, since there was a series of classes offered throughout the conference that involved meditation, I thought this would be a great opportunity to learn some of the techniques used to quiet the mind, and perhaps have access to willing test subjects for my own research. However, after preparing for this adventure, I decided to throw myself into the experience and leave my cumbersome EEG home, as it was clear to me this wouldn't be a journey to obtain data. Instead, this would be an opportunity to participate in what had been practiced for thousands of years, long before people relied on technology to validate their claims. The weather was blustery and unstable when I arrived, and the mist from the sea, coupled with high winds, added to the excitement. I liked the atmosphere, but the driver of the van that picked us up from the airport seemed slightly nervous. As we entered the resort and I could see people were trying to secure canopies and tents throughout the grounds, I had rented a bungalow which had two solid walls and two exterior walls built of screens with floor-to-ceiling blinds. I liked the space a lot. The large, fearless lizards were crawling across the screens and staring back at me. The humid breeze flooded the entire bungalow, and even when the rain came and went on that first night, I didn't mind at all when the interior became damp. Being totally connected with nature, I was looking forward to whatever the organizers of the event had planned. I tossed my suitcase on the floor, and as dusk came, I headed to the center of the grounds, where a huge campfire was illuminating the lush greenery and people's faces. With sparks flying up and flickering flames casting shadows everywhere, people's faces were shifting, as only the light from a fire can create. We were all moths being drawn to the flames, and everyone was greeting each other while scanning their surroundings, knowing we all were going to be a part of something special. It felt mysterious, maybe even slightly dangerous, with the burning logs snapping and the flames crackling. Eventually, everyone melted away into the night, heading to their tents and lodges. The next morning, the blowing of the conch signaled the first meal of the day was being served. A superb menu was posted in the outdoor cafeteria, and an assortment of Hawaiian cuisine was offered. It was all healthy and very satisfying. Several rows of long tables ensured you would be breaking bread with people you hadn't known before, but would seem like old friends by the end of the meal. The organizers pointed to the signs posted with various classes and workshops, and I signed up for several during the days and nights throughout the week. One class was titled Portal Building, and eight of us added our names to the roster. For the first few days, I attended large workshops and some of the smaller classes when I learned basic meditation methods. There is an unexpected surprise when you become mindful or conscious of the moment you are in. What begins as quiet introspection ends with a sudden rush of information about your surroundings near and far. It's the complete opposite of being attention deficit, and my ability to see and hear everything drastically improved as I worked to quiet my own inner voice. During the times I was not in a scheduled class, I explored Kalani. I could hear the waves hitting the ever-changing coastline of the island, and I ventured into an overgrown area where I found a trail leading to the cliffs overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The volcanic basalt creates beautiful black beaches and cliffs, topped with green vegetation. I found a large swing, easily wide enough for two people, and swung on it despite the fact I seemed to go slightly past the cliff with at least an 80-foot drop to the sea. After I had my fill, I stopped the swing and looked at the painting on it. I believe it said, "This magical place," and other words I couldn't decipher. I then heard the not-too-distant sounds of bongo drums. I ambled toward the drum beats and found two people. One was teaching the other to drum with several different percussion instruments. It was an instructor from Kalani, and I signed up for an hour-long spontaneous class on tribal drumming. It was all so perfect, and just what I had hoped Hawaii would be like. During all of this, there were the shifting winds and the constant mist that never seemed to be a bother at all, even when the tropical rain would suddenly drench everything. After several days, the evening of the portal building class had arrived. Those that signed up met at the designated sculpture in the center of the retreat, and we were led to a sweat lodge in a slightly secluded area. It is a low, round structure built with volcanic rocks that is open on two sides, but you have to duck to enter, and it's best to sit once inside. There was no electricity, and we needed flashlights to see. Once everyone was comfortable, our session began with Om runes, which is a type of chant that has a synchronizing effect on a group of people. This falls into a natural rhythm followed by silence, and then more ohms, etc. Now, some people open and close their eyes intermittently, but the effect is very calming. After nearly 40 minutes of this, several of us slightly opened our eyes, but not saying a word. I realized those with their eyes open, including myself, were looking at the section of the curved wall that had the same simple black cloth that is used to cover the two openings. At first, it seemed to look like fireflies had entered the sweat lodge, as it looked like tiny twinkling lights. But then they began to swirl in a rotating pattern that started to speed up and take on a purple hue. The swirling lights deepened in color and the circular pattern enlarged, with another triangular shape forming in the center. It was then that the image began to become clear. The shape I was seeing was that of a mantis head, but it was made of the same purple light. Although it was now clearly defined, it appeared to be approximately 18 inches across, and parts of the large upright body were also visible. The head moved from side to side, scanning all eight of us. Within minutes, it faded away. No one said a word the whole time until someone whispered, "Perhaps we should exit the sweat lodge." We all scrambled without hesitation and stood outside of the structure looking at each other, waiting for anyone to speak. Finally, one person asked, "What was that?" I believe none of us wanted to admit what we saw because each of us had no way of knowing what the others had seen, if anything. Another person finally said she thought she saw what looked like a giant insect. "Yes!" several of us blurted out. But as it turned out, this giant purple mantis that poked its scary head out of a swirling vortex was seen by five of the eight that were there. Those that saw it didn't feel threatened, but this type of sighting was not your average occurrence, which made it frightening. Although I have had an interest in studying enduring mysteries for many years, I was not familiar with creatures like this before, but have since read about others who have seen what many people call the mantis head aliens. I don't know if they're extraterrestrial, interdimensional, a shared ancient memory, or perhaps hallucinations of some sort. What I can say is that this conference was about healthy living, with three square meals a day, proper rest and exercise, and expanding the mind using centuries-old natural techniques. I did go back to the sweat lodge the next day to examine it thoroughly, looking closely at the rocks and black cloths while taking several photographs. There was absolutely nothing unusual about any of it. I'll never forget that portal-building class I participated in with those other people, and the mantis head that we experienced in Hawaii. The five of us saw the giant mantis. We're all now bonded in a way that only a life-changing experience like this can accomplish. The weather had become very calm as I left the island, but you never really leave Hawaii. A piece of you always remains, calling you back.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from
beyond the darkness.
Hello and welcome back. This is Beyond the Darkness. Today we're talking with Preston Dennett, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. And we just heard one of the more fascinating stories from your book, one of your more favorites. And certainly after hearing it, I understand why it's one of your favorites, Preston. I mean, that is unbelievable, the type of things that were taking place. Now, you'd right. mentioned a little bit of time travel. Do you have any other cases that actually involve a form of time travel?
Yeah, it kind of keeps turning up. It's very bizarre. There's another case in the book involving, well, not exactly time travel, but stopping time, I guess you would call it. It's an interesting case. This guy's actually a chiropractor. Really neat guy, very smart. He, back in, let's see, it was 1964. He was 11 years old. This is in St. Louis, Missouri. He went to go mail a letter. His mom sent him out to mail a letter about two blocks away at the local store. He's walking home, and suddenly He sees this object hovering right over him, just maybe 100 feet up, and he lives on a very busy street, and suddenly there's no cars at all, and which should be impossible. So he's very confused. Suddenly he's hit by a beam of light, and that's the last thing he remembers. Suddenly he's walking home. It's much later. When he gets home, his mom is furious. It's about 10 o'clock now, and she wants to know where he's been for the last hour. He tried to tell her, but she wasn't interested in hearing about any, you know, lights or object. He wasn't even thinking UFOs at this point, didn't really know much about them. But over the next week, he recalled exactly what happened during that missing hour, or at least some of it. Spontaneously came back to him. He recalled this light hitting him. Next thing he knows, he's on board, or presumably on board this craft. There are three Nordics, or human-looking males. They're dressed in jumpsuits, a black and white jumpsuit. He said that they were all very good-looking, Caucasian, not super long hair, but not super short. Definitely not like a crew cut, but kind of long, not shoulder length either, in between. But very good-looking and very similar-looking, very muscular-looking, and very kind. He says they had this kindness and this intelligence in their eyes that was just kind of consuming to him. And they had this long conversation. Now, here's the frustrating part. He doesn't remember what they said. He still doesn't remember, you know, years later. But that's basically all he recalled from that particular incident, that it started this sort of lifelong contact with him. They ended up moving out of the city to a farm. And on this farm, he would have missing time quite a bit with gray-type ETs. He'd see what he thought was a deer in the backyard or something like that. And he'd kind of see through the screen memory and see that it was actually a gray, and that'd be the last thing he remembers. But one of the more interesting incidents, and boy, he's got a lot of them, let me tell you. The whole family is screaming outside, come outside, because there's this UFO. And outside there's this metallic saucer. He said it was maybe 100 feet away, a typical flying saucer, lights all around it, and everyone's screaming and pointing at it. And he runs inside to get his rifle. Now, he's not planning on shooting this thing. He wants to look through the scope and see it up close. So he runs back outside with the rifle, sees the UFO, lifts the scope up and can't find the UFO, puts the gun down, and this is when it gets really bizarre. The UFO is gone, and he turns and looks at his mom and dad, and they're frozen in place. And so is his siblings, his brothers. And his dad is actually holding a bucket of milk or water, he doesn't remember which, but it's sloshing over the edge there, and it's stopped in space. No birds are flying. The trees aren't moving. Nothing's moving except him. He can move around fine. So this is obviously freaking him out. He turns to the front yard and sees that this UFO has now landed right there in the front yard, and three grays are coming out, walking towards him, and that's all he remembers. So I don't know what's going on there, but apparently they have the ability to stop time.
Well, sure, why not? I mean, if you can traverse time and space and dimensions, stopping time should be no problem, right?
Exactly. Yes. And if they can shrink their ships down. Mind you, I wrote about this in one of my other books, Not From Here. Other people have told me that, you know, they've seen these UFOs shrinking and expanding while they're inside of them. Certainly, there's a lot of cases of people seeing UFOs starting out as a ball of light and expanding to a mothership. But there's a case, oh, it's so interesting, from Leonard Stringfield. You know, there's a lot of cases where people have, you know, seen a small UFO, they're taken on board, and inside it's vast, it's huge. Well, there's this case from Leonard Stringfield involving a soldier, or actually a Army photographer who was sent to a base on a confidential assignment, top secret, to photograph a UFO. You know, we've heard this story before, this sort of story. He's photographing the outside of this UFO, which is about 30 feet wide, photographs the inside, and he says it's so big you couldn't throw a stone across it. It's like a gymnasium. So, yeah, these guys have a technology that controls space and time to a degree that we just can't do.
Well, that sounds like Time Lord technology. Doctor Who, bigger on the inside.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cases of it, you know, more turning up.
That is cool. All right, well, how about attacks? I mean, are these ever violent? Aside from the fact that you realize you've been abducted and maybe tested, is it ever violent? Are they ever left with injuries afterwards?
Generally speaking, I wouldn't call it violent. It's not always voluntary, certainly. I don't think this is a hostile phenomenon. I don't think UFOs are something we have to fear for the most part. I don't get really any accounts of what I would call sadistic behavior or torture or any, you know, ETs hurting people because they want to. The worst we get is people being treated like lab rats in very unfeeling ways. And yes, there are injuries. There's one case in the book about a gentleman who is now a college professor. Did not want me to use his real name, which of course I didn't use it. He came from a small town in Texas, and when he was 12 years old, he was delivering papers. This was back in 1961. At around 4 a.m. in the morning, he was delivering newspapers, as he always did on a Sunday, when he sees this light come swooping down across the horizon, and it stops right over his head. He's trying to figure out how high this thing is, but he doesn't know how big it is. It looked low. It had no running lights, he said. It had no wing lights, no strobes, just this giant ball of light, very bright. And suddenly it sends this beam of light down, and the next thing he knows, it's daytime. He's very confused. He's trying to think, you know, was this a plane? What's going on? Again, not thinking UFOs really at all. Starts delivering his papers as fast as he can. Gets home. Everyone's very angry at him. His boss, his mom, all his customers. And he's just exhausted, which he often is after delivering the papers. And he just usually sleeps for an hour or two. And that's what he did. But what happened is the next day, he was so exhausted he could barely get out of bed. And as the days progressed, you know, in less than a week, just a couple of days, he was so tired he couldn't get out of bed. They rushed him off to the hospital, and the doctors could not diagnose what was wrong with him. He just had this really bad weakness. And he connects it instantly, I mean, when this happened, to the UFO incident. And he's thinking, oh, maybe I was radiated by an atomic plane. That was his first theory for a long time. Didn't tell the doctors about it, by the way. I don't know why he couldn't tell me why he didn't tell the doctors. But the doctors prescribed a vitamin cocktail and sent him back home. And basically, he was bedridden the entire summer, was excused from all physical activities at school, and had a tough time recovering from apparently some type of radiation sickness. Is what his symptoms kind of mimic. And this is something I've heard from other cases. He had a rather mild case to some cases. I mean, he didn't, you know, have swelling or headaches or loss of appetite or weight loss, just this pervasive weakness. And it eventually did go away.
Boy, sign me up with the aliens that help you with weight loss. I'd like that deal.
Well, I don't know. Not through radiation sickness.
No, I guess you're right. The ends do not always justify the means.
Yeah, so his is an interesting case.
Yes.
He got very interested in UFOs, started reading books on it, and found out, oh, you know, I think I was abducted. Remembered as a kid seeing this bald, floating man with weird eyes outside his bedroom window as a kid before this incident. His sisters remember this incident. They come running up the stairs. He's screaming, and he's pointing to the window. And when they look, the man's gone. But, you know, it became one of these family incidents that people still talk about.
Sure.
And he eventually decided to go under hypnosis. Now, he's only one of two cases in the book using hypnosis. I think hypnosis works. I think that's been proven. But, you know, I kind of wanted to avoid any claims of false memory syndrome or
right.
anything like that. But we can basically throw that out of the water because, you know, like I said, most of the cases in this book don't even involve hypnosis. His does. And he went to this guy who is pretty well-versed in UFOs and said, well, you know, I can do this, but the fact that you've read all these UFO books means it's a possibility that what you recall will be contaminated. And he decided to go ahead anyway, goes under hypnosis, and recalls being sucked aboard through this beam of light into the UFO, and he says it was terrifying. He says it was so scary that he kept passing out, and he didn't see grays. He saw humanoids, which looked very much like grays, except they had kind of a yellowish skin or a bluish skin. One was much taller, but otherwise, you know, it had the large eyes and the large head often described. And they were just laying him out and examining him, and in many ways is the typical encounter. But he was not able to remain conscious through a lot of it just through, because of sheer fear.
Terror, right, yeah, I would guess that would put me out too.
Yeah, you know, I don't blame him, not a bit. And that was basically his experience. The only sort of after effect, he says, is he's gotten very interested in hands-on healing, sort of like Reiki, which is another thing I keep hearing. And this sort of harkens back to what I was telling you earlier. When someone's taken on board a UFO, the most common thing I hear is they're examined. But beyond that, they're given messages. The first most common is warnings. The second would be some message about healing. I'm guessing he probably had something like that but doesn't recall it because he's got this after effect that I see from other people who have gotten these messages of, you know, healing or spirituality or past lives, out-of-body travel, this type of thing. And the third message that people get is usually about alternative energy, in terms of, like, they're shown the engine room of the UFO and told how the UFO works, and in some cases actually, you know, given kind of instructions on how to build a sort of energy-free perpetual motion type device. Got a case like that in the book. So those are, this I think speaks to why they're here, the ETs. They have multiple agendas, obviously. I mean, they're no doubt hybridizing with us. I got cases like that from the beginning. But otherwise, they're giving these people these messages, which I think speaks to why they're here.
You talked about healings, and I think you mentioned in the first segment that they're, you know, we had a true theater of the mind last week, Friday, that appeared to be a healing from an alien or alien craft. What is the story that you've got?
This involves a lady. Did not want me to use her real name. She's a housewife from Nebraska. She says, I'm a nobody. My husband's not connected to anything. I have no idea why this happened to me. But she had a child, and following the birth of her child, she never lost the weight and started having hypoglycemia-type illness. Went to the doctor thinking, oh no, it's diabetes. She kept kind of having a lot of weakness and falling asleep after she ate. And doctors could not diagnose it. They said, no, it's not diabetes. Your blood count is normal. We don't know. Your blood sugars are normal. We don't know exactly what's going on. And it just got worse and worse. Every time she ate, she would pass out. And she'd have to walk around with food. She went to the doctor several times and did not get much help from them, she says. Ended up losing quite a bit of weight, going from like 160 or 70 pounds down to 110 or so, and just on this steep dive. And I was just terrified at this point that she was, you know, not going to get better. Was walking towards the couch one evening. Next thing she knows, she's no longer in her house. She's in, and this is bizarre, not a UFO like we normally hear, certainly, but more of an underground area. She says it was a very large dome-shaped room, as big as a school gymnasium at least, and it was filled with cubicles. And she was in one of the cubicles, and each cubicle had a sort of a bed or a table on it. And she was lying on one of the tables, and she could see the cubicle across from her. There was a man, and he was sort of dazed and looking at her. She felt very dazed as well. He introduced himself as Cooper. He was wearing sort of this plaid shirt. They started to talk and sort of small talk, trying to figure out what the heck was going on, where they were. There was no visible light source, but it was very bright in there. There was a lot of activity. She looks down the corridor separating them and sees this figure bounding towards her, walking very purposefully right towards her. Cooper, who's next to her, falls down in a faint and just is lying back on his table. And she looks up at this figure and just starts screaming because it's 9 feet tall. It's not human. It's wearing a cape, boots, and a kind of a dark clothes. And its face, she says, was much too large for a human. It had a very broad face. It had normal features for the most part. But its chin was much too large. Its forehead was much too large. Its eyes were strange. And it had orange straw-like hair that stuck straight out. And it wasn't really hair, she says. It was thick and like straw. In fact, that's why she contacted me. She says she wanted to find out if I had heard of any other ET like the one she described. And I had to tell her no. No, I haven't. And she's describing, you know, she sees this figure. It turns towards her and says, "All right, Jill, it's your turn now." And that just sends her over the edge. It lays her down on the table. It wraps her up in this cape-like thing and starts putting these metallic bell-like instruments on strategic parts of her body, sort of over her organs, she felt. She could feel these pulsing energy coming from it. And that's pretty much all she remembers. The next thing she knows, she's back in her living room in pretty much the exact spot she had been walking across the room. She's no longer screaming. She's calm. She's fine. She runs over to wake up her husband, and he will not wake up. She tries several times, and finally she runs to the children's room, tries to wake them up. They won't wake up. And finally, it took her about a half an hour, 20 minutes, to wake up her husband. She told him what happened. He was very supportive, to his credit, because their spouses often get thrown for loops by these kinds of stories. And what happened afterwards was what was most amazing is she was very sore. Her body was extremely sore, especially where these instruments had been. But after she ate, she did not faint like she normally did and didn't have any problems that whole day, felt much better. And as the week progressed, the pain in her body went away, the soreness, and she started gaining weight again and had no more problems with this illness that was, you know, suffered with for almost a year. So, yeah, she credits that experience to healing her.
That's awesome. Interesting stuff. Now, one thing, you know, and I know time's running out on us here. The title of Chapter 5, what is that, Woje? What is the Woje? What are the Woje?
Right, yeah, the great opportunity to meet this guy named Stan Hughes, who's a full-blooded blood Indian, a Native American, and has had these amazing encounters with what he calls the Woje, which are the star people, and he considers them kind of his ancestors. And these are sort of, I guess you're describing as Nordics. He did get a chance to have an actual face-to-face encounter. Has had dozens of sightings, actually, of these unexplained lights, but four or five that were extremely interactive, where they kind of gave him messages. But his ultimate encounter was where he's driving along the base of Thunder Mountain. This is sort of up in northern Washington near the upper Idaho Panhandle, that area. And along a dirt road, it's early in the morning, he's with his dog in a pickup truck. He hears this swishing sound, and he starts to feel sort of entranced or almost not hypnotized, but sort of calm, he says. Sedate, and he pulls over, and this craft, I guess I'll call it, lands in the road right in front of him. It was, he said, it covered the entire length of the road. It was perfectly round, and it was like chrome, like a silver mirror, just beautiful. A door opens, and out steps this figure. Not a door, just this opening appears, and out steps this 6-foot tall figure of a man. He says it's an absolutely beautiful man, very handsome, shoulder-length, dark hair, Arabic or Middle Eastern features, very dark eyes, dark eyebrows, but a very handsome man, and has this really sort of wonderful smile on his face and this loving look in his eyes, and walks right up to the front of the car, sort of raises his hand and kind of saying hello. And Stan says he was just overcome with this feeling of longing, wanting to go with this guy, and actually thought this, you know, take me with you. And he says as soon as he thought that, the man's smile dropped. He put his hand down. He turns around, walks back into the craft, which goes straight up and disappears. And he's like, wow, you know, he never fell asleep. As soon as this craft left, he started to feel sort of normal again. His dog never reacted at all. But he's like, wow, weird, right? I mean, this right. came down just to say hello. But other cases like this, you know, I've got other cases pretty much exactly the same as that.
You know, that pushes the question then, Preston. Have you ever had contact yourself, do you believe?
Not like this. Certainly not. Well, I certainly don't remember being taken on board or having missing time, and never saw a single UFO my whole life. But right after I started investigating this stuff, I started to have sightings pretty regularly. And I'm going to say it's because I actually was going out in those fields and looking for them. I was hooking up with contactees and abductees and going out with them. And I was successful seeing UFOs on a number of occasions. But I think at some point, I got targeted, or they know about me. And I'll tell you why, because get this, this is maybe a year into my research. You know, I got involved in 1986, got heavily involved in 1988, and started, you know, being a very serious researcher. And it was around that time, maybe in 89, July, late in the month, in the evening, I'm driving home after having talked with my sister-in-law and my brother about UFOs all night. Driving home, and I thought it was a bird at first, but this ball of light comes swooping down out of the sky and stops right in front of my windshield, maybe a foot off. It's a golf ball. It's a glowing sphere of light, and it darts back and forth, kind of in a sweeping, slow motion, maybe two or three times in front of my windshield, dips down a little bit, and then goes straight up. And I'm like, okay, you know, what the heck was that? Not a bird, not a golf ball, not a fireworks. You know, I mean, this thing was right in front of me. It targeted me. So, yeah, they know about me. That's happened after that, too. On the freeway, that happened to me once.
Are you ever worried that you're going to end up inside a UFO, ass up, getting probed, or are you kind of welcoming that idea eventually?
Yeah, fingers crossed. Well, maybe not the probing part, but...
Do a lot of the contactees that you've interviewed, do they have other paranormal encounters as well?
They do. That seems to be actually pretty common. It's not a rule by any means, but I started asking people, you know, what other unexplained experiences have you had? And it's not unusual that people will have psychic stuff, like precognitive dreams or precognition of some form. That's pretty common.
Well, sure, if they're taking them in time and space, they might be opening them up to these abilities where they can sense more or see more.
Yeah, that seems to be the exact connection that I found. They're attracted to people who are sort of spiritually aware or psychically aware, and people come away from these experiences doing, you know, like I said, hands-on healing. One guy became a water dowser. Another guy channels. One guy gives psychic readings. He can actually hear the ETs. They're telling him, you've got a job to do. They told him, this is our gift to you for what you've given us.
Wow.
That's definitely a pattern. That turns up quite a bit.
Very cool.
Yeah, ghosts as well. I've had one case so bizarre. These people were in the middle of this horrific haunting, which moved all the way to the possession stage, honestly, in an apartment in Van Nuys. And in the middle of it, they have this UFO come hovering right over their apartment, very low. So I don't know what's going on here, but definitely there are some weird connections there.
Well, you mentioned earlier how sometimes people would remember seeing a deer or seeing something and that was a false memory. Makes you wonder if people are having these ghost-like encounters or even cryptid encounters. Are they really seeing these things, or are they the aliens cloaking the memory and putting in a false memory of a ghost as opposed to alien contact?
Yeah, I think in some cases people are, that's probably true. People have doors opening and closing or footsteps and they attribute it to ghosts. And might not be ghosts.
Right.
And yeah, there's a weird bleed through in a lot of these cases. But for the most part, no, I don't think so. I think ghosts are ghosts and aliens are aliens, and they're separate phenomena.
Well, before we say goodnight, what are you working on next? What's your next project?
Oh, I've got another book coming out later this year, UFOs Over Colorado. So I'm excited about that. Working real hard now on undersea UFOs. I'll have a book on that next year, but boy oh boy, there's all kinds of USO activity off the Southern California coast here. So that's quite a story. But yeah, keeping busy interviewing people, and yeah, I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, Preston, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll put up a link to your book as well. We wish you all the best, and please let us know when your new books come out. We'll get you back on.
Hey, you got it.
All right, that's it for this week, folks. Be kind, love one another. Remember to be a little bit more understanding of the people around you. We need more love in this world than we do anger and aggression. And keep Timmy D in your prayers and thoughts. He'll be back with us Monday with more Parashare and Supernatural News. I'm Dave Schrader, and you've been listening to Beyond the Darkness.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Disease hit hard this year, huh?
Yeah. Mother Nature threw the kitchen sink at us. Tar spots, southern rust, we had everything.
I didn't know if my fungicide would hold, but Miravis Neo really came through. Even with that dry spell, our yield monitor did not disappoint.
Seriously?
Yep, and with results like this, I'm sticking with it.
No matter what next season brings, protect your ROI with Miravis Neo. Call your retailer to lock in your supply today. Always read and follow label instructions.